Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your call. As states continue various stages of reopening, more than 35,000 new cases were identified across the United States yesterday, according to a New York Times database. It was the highest single-day total since late April. More than 20 states are seeing COVID surges, mostly in the South and the West. Hospitalizations from COVID-19 are reaching new highs in so many states: Alabama, Arkansas, California, Florida, and Nevada. On Wednesday, California Governor Gavin Newsom said the state recorded more than 7,000 new cases after a steady few days of record highs. Texas Governor Greg Abbott reversed course and is now urging people to stay home. Some health officials in Texas advocate a strict stay-at-home order. Arizona's public health agency says 88% of ICU beds are now in use because of the COVID surge. And on the East Coast, New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut issued a travel advisory requiring people arriving from 9 states with high COVID rates to quarantine for 14 days. New Jersey, like so many other states, is seeing an increase in the percentage of COVID cases among young people ages 18 to 29. Here are the latest numbers from Johns Hopkins. There are now over 2.3 million positive COVID cases in the United States, and tragically, 122,020 people have died. On Wednesday, the World Health Organization said that if governments and communities in the Americas are not able to stop the spread of the virus, there may be a need to impose or reimpose lockdowns. So on today's Your Call, we are talking about where we are today and what we need to do in the coming months, given that there's not much action happening from the federal government. Joining us is William Schaffner, professor of preventive medicine in the Department of Health Policy, as well as professor of medicine in the Division of Infectious Diseases at the Vanderbilt University School of Medicine in Nashville, Tennessee. Dr. Schaffner is medical director of the National Foundation for Infectious Diseases and has served on the executive board for the Infectious Diseases Society of America. Hi, Dr. Schaffner. Thanks so much for joining us.
Well, hello, Rose. Good to be with you.
Well, it's great to have you. We are also joined by Professor Arthur Reingold, Division Head of Epidemiology and Biostatistics at UC Berkeley School of Public Health. Professor Reingold has worked for over 40 years on the prevention and control of infectious diseases at the national level, including 8 years at the CDC. Hi, Professor Reingold. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, nice to be with you and with my good friend, Dr. Schaffner.
Well, it's great to have both of you. And, you know, it's been hard to read all of the information over the last couple of days because the cases are just surging. And Professor Reingold, we're seeing hospital stays now hitting highs in many states. Texas is now reversing course on reopening. How do you explain where we are today, Professor Reingold?
Well, unfortunately, it's fairly simple infectious disease epidemiology, and I think that I, like many people, perhaps underestimated this virus a few months ago and perhaps overestimated the capacity of our system to respond appropriately. You know, this is a highly transmissible virus. The problem is made worse by the fact that people can transmit when they're asymptomatic, and I think we have a real problem convincing people that they should wear masks and do other things. So it's not too surprising that the virus is continuing to spread, and unfortunately in some individuals making them quite sick.
Professor Schaffner, what would you add?
Well, I certainly agree with my friend Art, and I would just say we had hoped, some of us, that this COVID virus would take something of a summer vacation and be less transmissible in the heat and humidity. But that's off the table. This virus has not taken a summer vacation. It's being widely transmitted. And as Professor Reingold said, there are a lot of people out there whom we haven't yet persuaded to wear masks and not attend large group gatherings. Those are ideal environments for this COVID virus to be transmitted. It's very contagious.
Right. And it doesn't help that people are getting mixed messages from the federal government. I mean, I've been watching various activities from Trump and other people, and they're not wearing masks. They're not social distancing. Professor Reingold, that doesn't help. It really sends a bad message.
Well, I think we know that in public health that you know, getting people to adopt certain behaviors or to change their behaviors is really difficult. And they really have to be motivated, whether it's by fear or guilt or something. But otherwise, it's very, very difficult to get people to get out of their lane and do something different. And getting mixed messages from different levels of government, or frankly, we in public health have also been guilty of having our message evolve or change over time in ways that haven't been well explained. So I can understand the difficulty we're facing. This is hardly the only public health problem where getting people to change their behaviors is difficult.
What are your thoughts on that, Professor Schaffner?
For sure, you have to start with good modeling. So the leaders all have to be on the same page. I wish it had been that, as in the case of previous infectious disease threats to this country, influenza outbreaks, Ebola, Zika virus, that the public health leadership would have been taking the lead and doing the sustained communications. Sure enough, we've had to change our messages as we've learned more about the virus, but the messaging has been chaotic at the national, state, and local level. And I agree, it's no wonder that the average Jane or Joe are confused.
Right. And I guess if we can just be real here, you know, we've done two shows about these excellent frontline documentaries where correspondents spoke with a number of professors, epidemiologists, scientists like yourself. We now know that the administration got very strong warnings on December 31st, that's when the warnings came in, and they were either ignored or people were sidelined. And so now here we are. Trump is going out and doing rallies. There's thousands of people not wearing masks and yelling and screaming. And that's how we know where transmissions can easily break out. So, Professor Reingold, given the realities that we're facing with the federal government wanting to even pull back on testing, what do we do from here? I mean, every state obviously is different. Every county in some cases is different. But now even small counties that had no cases 3 months ago are now seeing small outbreaks. So how do we tackle this given lack of action from the federal government?
So I'm not optimistic we'll see a more proactive approach at the national level from politicians. And I think the other lamentable piece of this is Bill knows. It has been the virtual silencing of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, which really should be very front and center and prominent, and clearly have not been allowed to give the messages that it needs to give. So, you know, I think since I don't have optimistic expectations that that's going to change in the next few months, I think we at the state level, at the county level, particularly counties like San Francisco, which have really been doing great work, need to reinforce our messages and try and work together at the local level or within a state or across Western states or something to really give people the right messages and if necessary, you know, put into place the right strictures. But it's very, very difficult. As people know, we have health officers and health officials being threatened. Their houses being picketed, their children being threatened. I mean, this has really become a very acrimonious and difficult situation.
Mm. Professor Schaffner?
Yeah, so bear with me. You know, when the virus first came from China, understandably, it caused most of its damage. It spread the most in major metropolitan areas where people were very close together. And then it began to creep out. And over the months, and now continuing this summer, it's gone from large cities to medium-sized to small cities, and now it's leaking out across into rural areas. So now, when the fall comes, the fall and the winter, this virus is now disseminated throughout the country in a pretty even fashion. And if we do have, as most of us anticipate, a serious second wave, so to speak, this fall, along with influenza, it will happen all over the country more or less simultaneously. I'm very concerned about that. Unless we train ourselves now to be careful, to use the mask, social distancing, avoid large groups, we're going to be in real doo-doo, if you will, this fall and winter.
So it seems like there's a huge responsibility on the part of state officials, local officials, and the media to really get the word out and be real about where we are and how we got here, but to also give people the information they need. And I think what's so hard about this, Professor Reingold, is people are really hurting financially, especially people of color, people who are already on the margins, are now even worse off. I mean, we're still seeing long food lines across the country. In many states, even California, people are not getting their unemployment checks. So that's the other problem here, is that people need to work again. People need to bring in some money to make ends meet.
So, you know, that's clearly the case. And, you know, people like me have the luxury of being able to continue to do my job and stay safe by working from home and still get a paycheck. And that's clearly not true for many, many people who are hurting economically and people we depend on so we can all buy food at the grocery store and get our prescriptions from the pharmacy and the like. So we need to do a better job of protecting those people as they support us. You know, now I would argue that part of that is an economic and political decision. That those are people we need to help financially over the coming months, much more than we have so far. The individuals need to be targeted and given financial support. And because states like California cannot run a deficit, this help really needs to come from federal government.
Right. And Professor Schaffner, we just got news today that another almost 1.5 million workers are newly unemployed, and that extra $600 in weekly unemployment benefits from the federal government runs out next month. So we're in a crisis, and it's going to get worse.
This is very, very painful. There isn't any doubt. The economy is not going to be a V, a sharp downturn and a sharp upturn. It will take time to recover. And we need to guard against the spread of this COVID virus because that will further prolong the economic distress. And so we need to focus on this public health problem right now in order to avoid further concern and distress down the road. I don't believe that we're going to shut down again. Nobody would do that. But if the virus is out there causing major medical problems and disrupting commerce again just because of illness, that will further prolong the time to recovery.
That is William Schaffner, Professor of Infectious Diseases at Vanderbilt University. Arthur Reingold is Division Head of Epidemiology and Biostatistics at UC Berkeley's School of Public Health. Today we are talking about the surge in COVID cases across the country, where we are today, and where we're going. If you have any questions or comments for our guests, you can email us yourcall@kalw.org. You can also give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also tweet us at Your Call Radio. Let's take a couple of topics individually. Let's first talk about asymptomatic testing. According to Maria Van Kerkhove, a top WHO official, she said, "We still don't know the percentage of people who are asymptomatic. Estimates suggest that anywhere between 6% and 41% of the population may be infected but do not have symptoms." Professor Reingold, what are your thoughts on this? Should we be testing more people to find out how many are asymptomatic?
So I think one needs to understand what those percentages that you quoted are. I think it's clearly the case that many people who become infected never have symptoms or have only the mildest of symptoms. And some estimates are that that could be in the range of 10 to 20% or maybe more of people who acquire this infection. You know, the proportion of the population that is infected, we still think in virtually every area, including places like New York, is quite low. That is no more than 10 to 15%, maybe 20% of the population. And what that means is that the overwhelming majority of our population is still completely susceptible to infection this coming fall and winter in the absence of a vaccine. So, you know, the question of who should be tested when, I think, is a very complicated issue. And seeing lines of thousands of people waiting to be tested, I personally find confusing, and maybe Bill can explain this better than I can. You know, we need testing to diagnose when people are ill with this virus and treat them correctly. We need that in order to guide isolation and quarantine efforts and contacts. But whether having large numbers of people show up to be tested periodically outside of a research study, I have to say I'm not entirely clear what we gain from that. But Bill can explain it, I'm sure.
Bill?
Well, I can't, because here in Tennessee, although we have testing now widely available, anybody who wants it can get a test, that's really being discouraged. And our state public health department is indeed focusing on high-risk groups, which is, I think, what ART would do, too. Nursing homes, prisons, agricultural workers, and manufacturing sites where there are small outbreaks among the personnel working in the factory. And I think that's a much more traditionally appropriate public health use of testing. Also, we're doing contact tracing, and in that context, we're using testing also.
Well,
you know, we at the universities are struggling with this question for the fall, how we will use testing to reopen the universities. This is an issue all across the country. Who should be tested when and with what frequency and what we can accomplish with that. So I think this is a very complicated and complex problem, frankly.
And according to Politico, the federal government is ending its support for 13 drive-through COVID testing sites on June 30th, urging states to take over their operations even as cases spike. Do either of you know why this is happening?
Well, of course, the president has said we should do less testing and then we'll have fewer cases. An interesting view about an infectious disease problem. So whether it's because the government has decided they would like to see less testing or simply shift the responsibility in a federalist country, I don't know. But, you know, certainly California and virtually every other state at this point is facing large deficits that you know, put them in a very difficult position to pay for things.
Let's spend some time talking about basic protections. Last Thursday, California Governor Gavin Newsom announced a statewide mandate to wear masks in high-risk settings, including outdoor spaces, inside restaurants, that's really important, and workspaces. Can you both talk about why wearing a mask? And be sure, because I've seen some people have the mask under the nose or above the chin. Can you talk about why wearing a mask above the nose and right below the chin is so important? Professor Reingold?
Well, obviously, if you don't have your nose and mouth covered, then you're defeating the purpose of wearing a face covering or a mask, which is, you know, we like to say in part to protect those around you. From your exhalations, from your coughing and sneezing, and you're putting virus into the shared air or onto surfaces. We like to hope that it also provides you an element of protection, although frankly the information around what types of masks and all of that and how well they protect people is, I find, a little confusing. But the hope is, and Bill can, I'm sure, elaborate on this, we will reduce at least the risk of transmission when people are in proximity to each other.
Right. Professor Schaffner?
One of the most difficult things I've found for the average person to grasp is this concept of asymptomatic transmission, and that they, as a person, even though they're feeling completely well, might indeed be harboring the virus and be contagious to others. I think that's a hard thing for people to get their brains around. And then wearing the mask, which traditionally has been thought of as protecting me, for the purpose of protecting others, is also a hard thing for people to understand. Beyond the fact that masks are cumbersome and are different in our culture and, frankly, have become politicized. Right. And so the wearing of the mask has become very, very confusing and difficult. And in California now, and I think in other states or at least municipalities, will have to become mandatory in order for us to keep the curve, as we say, flattened.
We have an email from Sarah who says, I have an analogy that might persuade more people to wear masks. Everybody's body is a potential lethal weapon. Only those who have the privilege of being tested every day can know if their body is loaded or not. The rest of us need to assume that our body is loaded. To protect everyone, we need to keep our body's safety on. It's pretty easy to do, wear a mask. And she was saying it's kind of like a lethal weapon, like a gun. There was a good piece in the Wall Street Journal yesterday called How Exactly Do You Catch COVID? There's a growing consensus. It says surface contamination and fleeting encounters are less of a worry than close-up person-to-person interactions for extended periods. The major culprit is close-up person-to-person interactions, crowded events, poorly ventilated areas, and places where people are talking loudly or singing, in one famous case, maximize the risk. Professor Reingold, there have been some really interesting videos about, let's say, three groups are at a restaurant at three tables, and depending on the air ventilation, one asymptomatic person can affect, let's say, four people at her table, and then five people at another table and no one at the third table. It really depends on the air ventilation. It's just fascinating to learn about how this works.
So, one other element I would add to your very good list of things is that we do think that exposures indoors represent more of a threat than exposures outdoors. But clearly, the key issue is primarily the amount of time spent in close proximity to other people who are infected. And so that's why a lot of the transmission occurs within the household setting or in these congregate care settings, prisons and the like. So which is why we think we can make a difference through things like masking and social distancing. And I have to say, I've had the luxury for the past couple months of living up in Sonoma. And frankly, when I go shopping, the stores are very clear. If you don't have a mask, you can't come in. And everyone wears a mask when they're indoors. Right. So it is possible, even here in California, to get people to do this.
And to that point about indoor versus outdoor, Professor Schaffner, so far a few studies about the protests are showing that there are thankfully very few cases. We're talking about maybe a 1% positive. But now we're seeing, for example, here in the Bay Area, the Buckeye restaurant, which is in Mill Valley, had to shut down after reopening because two people there tested positive. And in this Wall Street Journal piece, they point out that at a March 10th church choir practice in Washington State, 87% of attendees were infected.
Yes. So as Art said, prolonged exposure face-to-face indoors. And so periodically when COVID attends such an event, you're going to get a cluster of infections. Singing, very interesting, right? Because that's inhaling and exhaling with force and projecting your voice. Clearly, the virus was projected over a large group of people and infected a large group, a so-called super spreading event. Let me add one other thing. We hear people saying they don't want to wear a mask because it's their own personal decision. And let me make a decision for myself. a so-called individual freedom kind of argument, a libertarian argument. But that overlooks the fact that this is a communicable virus. It's contagious. So the decision you make affects not just you, but everyone around you. And when I've had the occasional discussion with somebody who was of that point of view, that makes them very uneasy. But that's the issue. We all have to work together in order to address this problem because it is contagious. It's not just about you. It's about all of us.
William Schaffner is professor of infectious diseases at Vanderbilt University. Arthur Reingold is division head of epidemiology and biostatistics at UC Berkeley's School of Public Health. Today, we are getting an update on the COVID surges that we're seeing across the country. Where are we today, and how can we get a handle on this without action from the federal government? This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our media roundtable. We will talk about the COVID crisis in Brazil. They have the second highest death toll in the world after the United States. And then we'll talk about how Republicans are exploiting the pandemic to restrict access to abortion across the country. Today, we are talking about the surge we are seeing across the country in COVID cases. How can we get a handle on this without action from the federal government? And today we're joined by Arthur Reingold, division head of epidemiology and biostatistics at UC Berkeley School of Public Health. William Schaffner is professor of infectious diseases at Vanderbilt University. And if you have any questions or comments, here we are. It's the end of June. And in some cases, we're still really pleading with people to take these basic measures. You know, when we talked about them back in February, I mean, back then people said, no, don't wear masks. But shortly thereafter, scientists and experts said, yes, wear masks. So if you have any questions or comments, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Can we talk a little bit about contact tracing? Many countries, China, South Korea, and Germany, have set up extensive contact tracing programs. But here, states and cities started their programs only a couple of weeks ago. We are already seeing some difficulties. According to the New York Times, New York City's contact tracing program called Test and Trace Corps reported that contact tracers were seeing a low cooperation rate. Professor Reingold, first off, can you talk about the importance of contact tracing?
It's actually an old technique in public health. It certainly has been done for syphilis cases for a long time and for TB cases. And I think the logic is fairly clear that if I can identify the people you had sex with, if you have syphilis, I can maybe identify people who are incubating syphilis, treat them, and prevent ongoing transmission. So clearly it's an old model that can work. I think there are a couple of things I would say. One is that, as my wife has explained to me, and she's an expert in this, contact tracing is actually a fairly complex set of interactions with people. It's not just getting somebody on the phone and asking them a bunch of questions. It's much more complicated than that and really requires a number of different skill sets, and then a great deal of follow-up for people. So not quite as simple as just hiring a bunch of people and making a lot of phone calls, number one. And number two, once you've got enormous numbers of people, hundreds or thousands of people being identified, the magnitude of the problem with contact tracing really begins to be almost unsustainable in terms of doing what we say we're going to identify all your contacts and follow up and quarantine people or isolate people once we test them as positive. So it can work on a smaller scale of numbers of cases. Whether it can really work or how well it can work when you reach a really large scale, maybe Bill can give me a better answer on that. But I'm a little concerned that people may have unrealistic expectations about what contact tracing can do.
Well, to that point, Perry Halkitis, Dean of the School of Public Health at Rutgers, which is guiding its contact tracing program, said for each person, you should be in touch with 75% of their contacts within a day. So this is a lot of work. This is a huge undertaking, Professor Schaffner.
Well, first of all, just as Art said and as the dean said, it is a huge undertaking, and we are understaffed to do that. Also, importantly, just to reinforce something that Art has said, I learned this when I was a very young person in public health. It takes skill to get the confidence of people so that they will actually tell you who all their contacts are. And just hiring a bunch of new people and giving them phone numbers or email addresses to contact will lead to some results, but you probably will not get a complete picture. And then just to make the job even more complicated, as though we need to, many of these patients, people who are infected, I should say, are without symptoms or have very mild symptoms and don't come to medical attention. That makes the challenge for this kind of infection even higher. Should we not do it? No. I think we ought to do it, but we ought to understand it's one arrow in our quiver. We can't rely on it completely. We have to do the universal social distancing, wearing of masks, avoiding going out to groups. So we need to do the mitigation activities that I've just talked about, as well as the contact tracing containment activities. We need to do them both.
We should mention that the Attorney General of California is urging people to answer the phone and talk to contact tracers. But we also want to urge people to be aware of scammers, because there have been many reports about people calling others saying, "Hi, I'm a contact tracer. Can I get your Social Security information and your financial information?" And the Attorney General, Javier Becerra, in California says you will never be asked for that kind of information. So this is a tough one, Professor Reingold, because we want people to talk to tracers, but people also need to be wary of potential scammers.
Well, it's a very difficult thing to negotiate. That's exactly one of the reasons there are people doing unscrupulous and type things, pretending to be contact tracers. But even absent that problem, as Bill said, gaining someone's trust, and getting the information, getting them on the phone, getting them to talk to you, is really not just a question of epidemiology. It's a much more complicated issue. And I think that the other piece to mention is that if people have mentioned, for example, we have fancy apps that can be used to identify people you've been in close touch with through your phone or something like that. There are potential benefits to programs like that, at least in countries where privacy concerns may be less than they are here. But even that approach has some downsides in that if you end up identifying much larger numbers of people you need to follow up with, you need an even bigger workforce. And so if you don't budget for this, if you don't hire the people and train the people, if you don't convince potential contacts that it's to their benefit rather than to their detriment to answer questions, then you'll have trouble being successful with this.
Yeah,
we have
Rose,
a question.
Let me just
go ahead
to that, if I may. So here's another dimension that's particularly apropos in this current environment. We've both said this requires trust, and we all know that populations of color are disproportionately affected by this disease. And this is a time when people of color don't have the trust in government, and the health department is a governmental agency. And you're asking people to go back in their minds to think about all their contacts of all sorts over a period of time and give the contact tracer their name, their phone number, their email address, so that they themselves may be contacted. This is a very sensitive, delicate, and important issue. To do it right, just for starters, you need to hire people from the communities that are going to be contacted so they can have a better rapport, a better contact with the cases and get their trust. So, as you can see, we've been saying for the last 5 minutes, this is a very complicated challenge.
Well, we have a question about contact tracing from a listener. Let's hear from Mark in San Francisco. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. You know, I think my question may have been covered in the last few minutes. I basically wanted to know about people who are, say, for example, ride buses and are in crowds of various kinds unavoidably, and furthermore, are some of the people who are perhaps most likely to be infected, and, you know, how do you do such contact tracing? And I wanted to tag on to that, I think it was mentioned as well, that it seems like an obvious solution to that is to do something like tracking people by their phones, and that sounds like a very scary prospect that could be carried forward in a way to violate people.
Exactly. I mean, that would be very, very difficult here because of so many privacy concerns. Professor Reingold, what are your thoughts?
So I have a little trouble hearing the caller. I don't know if Bill heard him better than I did.
Yeah, I heard him.
He wanted to know how you contact trace people who ride public transportation.
Well, I think what this really says is that, you know, in theory, if we use cell phone data and things like that, that you know, I can figure out that you were in touch with people where you didn't know it or you couldn't identify them because they were on BART with you or something. So in theory, that's a benefit of using these more modern approaches. I think the downside is that, you know, many of those contacts will have been incidental for a short period of time. And the juice may not be worth the squeeze in terms of trying to follow up with all the people you might have stood next to on BART. So that's part of this really complicated discussion, if you will, is which contacts are most important to follow up on, and how many contacts do you need to identify for an individual and successfully track. So I don't have a simple answer to the question, but it's complicated.
Right. Professor Schaffner, what would you add?
Yes, I do think it's complicated, and I would reinforce again what Art has said, namely many of these contacts, quote-unquote, will have been transient, and they are not the sort of high-risk contacts from prolonged face-to-face contact in an interior space. Everything we do also is imperfect. We can't get them all, so you have to focus on the high-yield sorts of contacts.
Well, thank you for the call. I also just want to bring into the conversation that NBC is reporting the Trump administration has been sitting on $14 billion, that's $14 billion with a B, in funding that Congress passed for coronavirus testing and contact tracing. This is according to Democratic Senators Chuck Schumer and Patty Murray. Democrats said in a letter to Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar that the administration has failed to distribute more than $8 billion out of $25 billion appropriated by Congress to expand testing and contact tracing. You know, I'm sure you're not going to even know how to answer this question, but I keep wondering, you know, the coronavirus is now affecting places where people did not want to wear masks. I mean, it's now in deep Trump country. So I just wonder, why would the administration pull back on this, knowing that people who are, you know, hardcore Trump voters could get sick and possibly die from this disease?
Well, of course, that's a political question, not a health question. But you know, I would say the backdrop here is a lack of faith in science and science-based approaches to things, and perhaps a belief that, you know, if you think something, if you don't want something to be a problem, you can make it not a problem by not thinking about it. That's magical thinking, which rarely works.
Works for ostriches, but not for us.
Well, and to that point, I mean, to bring it back to a scientific question, which is still political, when you look at what happened with the CDC, the BuzzFeed has a piece out called "The CDC Lost Control of the Coronavirus Pandemic, Then the Agency Disappeared. The world's premier health agency pushed a flawed containment strategy until it disappeared from public view one day before the outbreak was declared a pandemic." Professor Reingold, you worked at the CDC for 8 years. Can you give us any insights? I mean, what are your former colleagues saying about what happened to the CDC?
Not only did I work for them for 8 years, I still work extensively with them in a network that Bill and I collaborate on, funded by CDC. And as it happens, my wife currently works for CDC. So I have quite a bit of investment in that organization, and perhaps not an unbiased view, but I think it's one of the most serious problems we've had in the last 4 or 5 months is the absence from the national discussion of effective leadership from CDC. And of course, that's a political decision made in Washington as to who is going to be on the podium and speaking and have the freedom to give messages. And I would argue that that's been a major problem.
Anything to add, Professor Schaffner?
Well, in the interest of transparency, I like to call myself a president of the CDC fan club. I also worked at the CDC for 2 years and continue to work with Art on programs that the CDC sponsors. And we do so enthusiastically because we think that they're important. I think we need a serious after-action report. I think some of the difficulties were self-inflicted by the CDC, and others were imposed. But clearly, it has lost a lot of the shine that was on that wonderful organization, and it will take some time for it to regain its sense of self-confidence and primacy in the area of public health, and in particular, in communicable disease amelioration.
Well, let's go to another caller. Let's hear from Kay. Hi, Kay. Thanks for holding. Is Kay with us? Did we lose Kay? All right, let's go to Leon in San Francisco. Hi, Leon.
Hi there, Rose. Number one, you've got one of the best shows on local radio, so please keep up the good work.
Thank you.
And just a tip, in case your audience hasn't heard, I'm sure many people have seen the slow motion videos of how far the droplets and aerosolized particles go when somebody coughs. Well, the latest information is also that when you flush a toilet does very much the same thing. So just a tip to the wise is to keep this from spreading anymore is put the toilet seat down before you flush.
Or if you're in a public bathroom, spend as little time as you can in there, flush it and run. I mean, because those toilets don't have seats usually, and
yeah,
the water really just jumps out of those public toilets.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for that. That's an important one, Leon. A lot of people were talking about that last week. Professor Schaffner, are there any other, it's hard to think that we're still sharing basic tips, 5 months in, but are there any other basic tips you'd like to share with people?
Well, let me just respond to that last piece. We have to be careful not to put the emphasis on the wrong syllable. Yes, toilets are yucky and you don't want to spend any time around them. That's not a mode of transmission of COVID. Let's put that out of our minds. Close person-to-person contact, particularly in an enclosed space. Let's keep the emphasis where it ought to be and not go running down little byways. I think we all have to work together. This is a communal problem. It may take obligation, the way things have evolved in California, so that you now must wear a mask. I'm on the verge of suggesting that here in Tennessee, although there's a great deal of reluctance to do that, people still hope that we can persuade folks to do it. I'm rather skeptical, but we need to do this on a personal basis in a sustained way if we want to have any hope in keeping the curve as flat as we can.
You know, to that point, Professor Schaffner, what are your thoughts on the media's role in all this? Because I just searched toilet and COVID. Major mainstream outlets have stories about this, you know, using public bathrooms during COVID. What goes in the toilet doesn't always stay there. What are the guidelines for toilet spread? Studies suggest coronavirus can spread from toilet spray, on and on and on.
The media have been great, and they have been not so great, pursuing the latest shiny object without first vetting it very, very carefully. We're all prisoners of the 24-hour news cycle. I think I've had the best success in talking about COVID when people are calm and I have a chance to talk to them for about 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. That's in part why your program is a success. We need to spend more time. Sound bites alarm. They don't often enlighten.
Right. Anything to add, Professor Reingold?
Well, just to speak to the toilet issue for a second, I think the problem is that some things are theoretically possible, or where there are laboratory experiments that demonstrate something could happen. And so the idea that the virus is in human feces is you know, and therefore aerosols are created by toilets that are uncovered when they're flushed. It is all, you know, in one sense true, but as Bill says, the real question is to what extent is that really a risk and does it account for spread of the virus in the community? So how much of it is a theoretical concern versus, in fact, a real problem? And so I do think we do get a lot of overreactions to what are theoretical concerns or laboratory findings without enough information about how much of a real-world problem they are.
In our final minutes, if you can both talk about where we need to go in the coming weeks. I'm just looking at the front door of The Guardian right now. California sees a 69% rise in 2 days as LA has the most cases. In Texas, COVID cases hit all-time daily high as Houston hospitals are near capacity. Data shows 10 countries risking a second wave as a lockdown is relaxed. If you look at the lines, the EU is really flattening the curve where the United States is just going up, up, up. So, Professor Schaffner, what are your thoughts about where we need to go in the next couple of weeks?
Well, I think during this period of time we've been together, we've been saying where we really need to go. We need to go to compliance with what it is that public health has suggested, has told us that we need to do. We need to focus on wearing masks, avoiding large groups, and paying attention to social distancing. Stay 6 feet away from as many people as you can. And those people who are older, who have chronic underlying illnesses, who are more susceptible to getting severe disease, you ought to continue to shelter in place and go out very, very cautiously. We need to do all of those things together in order to try to mitigate the impact of this really very contagious, nasty virus on our population.
Professor Reingold?
Well, I would echo that, just a couple of other quick points. One, we need to redouble our efforts to protect people who are in group settings, whether it's nursing homes or prisons or other congregate settings. That's really important, and we need to up our game in terms of making sure that people who have to work in those facilities are not introducing the virus. So we need to do it in a humane way, but that's really important. And I think we do need to take more personal responsibility for our actions. We are not going to have a vaccine for this anytime in the next several months, that's for sure. We will have ongoing transmission, and I worry a great deal about our healthcare providers and seeing what we saw in New York happen in hospitals in Houston or Phoenix or a host of other places.
And just briefly, we're seeing hospitalization rates go up in certain states. What are your thoughts about, and we need more time for this, but I just wonder quickly, Professor Schaffner, your thoughts about people healing from the disease versus people not making it. Is there any new information on that?
Would you clarify the question, please?
Sure. So, for example, hospitalizations, people being intubated, people dying. Is there any new information about what we're learning about those rates?
Yes, for sure. We're able to, as we have learned more about COVID and how it makes us seriously ill, and we have learned a terrific amount over the last several months, and we now have two drugs, remdesivir and that steroid dexamethasone, that we can use to mitigate some of that impact on people who are in intensive care units, shorten their stay, and actually improve survival. There are many studies of therapies currently underway around the world. I think we're going to start harvesting some of those results during the summer. So I hope maybe we have even further therapies that we can use. We're getting better at getting people out of the intensive care unit and getting them back home.
William Schaffner is professor of infectious diseases at Vanderbilt University, and Arthur Reingold is division head of epidemiology and biostatistics at UC Berkeley School of Public Health. Thank you both for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rose, for a great show, and Bill, I'm sure we'll be talking.
Indeed, Arthur.
Thank you both, and please stay healthy. And you can find more information about COVID and all of the information that we discussed today. Thanks to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance and Damian Miner for keeping our studio running. And I hope you can join us for tomorrow's Media Roundtable. We will talk about the COVID crisis in Brazil. That country now has the second highest COVID-19 death toll in the world after the United States. Later in the show, we'll talk about how Republicans are exploiting the COVID pandemic to restrict access to abortion across the country. Will also get an update on the Supreme Court's first major ruling on abortion rights. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.